It's The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega, and we're coming to you today and tomorrow from KPCC in Pasadena, California, and it's great to be here. On Monday, California Attorney General Javier Becerra announced a coalition of 16 states would be suing the federal government over the Trump administration's declaration of a national emergency.
He knows this is not a national emergency. He even said in that state, in that announcement,
and we will have a national emergency, and we will then be sued, and they will sue us in the Ninth Circuit, even though it shouldn't be there, and we will possibly get a bad ruling, and then we'll get another bad ruling, and then we'll end up in the Supreme Court, and hopefully we'll get a fair shake, and we'll win in the Supreme Court, just like the ban.
I think he's gonna be wrong on all these different counts when it comes to where he can go. But we'll do what we have to do. If Congress won't set him straight, then we'll go to court to make sure that we make him respect the rule of law.
Both sides are digging in for a protracted legal battle, and even if President Trump does win out, it could be a while before he gets funding for the wall. Here to walk us through what happens next is Jennifer M. Chacon, a law professor at UCLA, and Danny Savalas, a legal analyst with MSNBC. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Danny, let's get started with you. So much happening here. What legal argument are these 16 states trying to make in this lawsuit?
There are a couple different arguments. One is that there was never really a national emergency if, and this has two prongs, the president spoke about it for many, many months, even years, and never did anything about it. And part two, if he said in so many words, I didn't need to do this, that also undermines the existence of a national emergency. The second argument, and I think probably ultimately the stronger argument for the state's lawsuit, is not so much can the president declare a national emergency, it's where is he going to get the money to pay for this stuff? But I have to say, as a preliminary issue, a threshold determination that any court is going to have to make, and by any court, I mean all the way up the appeals courts and up to the Supreme Court, is going to be an issue called standing. In other words, do the states have any business suing the federal government to tell it what to do with its own federal military spending and funds? I think that may be one of the early battlegrounds in this lawsuit for the states, because historically, it's not exactly clear that states have a right to sue the federal government on behalf of its citizens or to change government, federal government policy.
And Jennifer, I want to ask you, from your perspective as a constitutional law professor, what kind of legal questions does the president, on the president's side, does his declaration of a national emergency bring to mind?
So it raises a number of legal issues that are very interesting, and I think it raises a memory of a similar incident that happened in the 1950s with President Truman when he declared a national emergency and attempted to seize the steel mills. There was a labor action that threatened to close down all of the nation's steel mills. There was an ongoing war in Korea, and President Truman said, there's an emergency, we really need steel production, and so I'm going to seize the mills. And he attempted to do so and was sued. And the Supreme Court actually said that he had exceeded his constitutional authority in seizing the mills. And what they said in that case was, we're dealing with a situation where, in fact, Congress has thought about this issue, has declined to provide emergency powers to the president around this issue, has declined to write legislation that would seize the steel mills, and has made the determination that it's not necessary. And so the president here is acting without express constitutional authority, without statutory authority, and in contravention of congressional decision making. Therefore, he's acting at the lowest ebb of his power, and that could be comparable to the situation that we're in here.
And I'm just curious, like, in terms of where, when we look at the declaration itself, how unprecedented it is estimation.
So he's made the declaration under the National Emergencies Act, and we do know that many presidents have used the National Emergencies Act in a variety of situations, usually to deal with funds for a small number of people who have been accused of terrorist activities, those sorts of things. We saw George W. Bush do it, obviously, in response to the attacks of September 11th, 2001. But this kind of a large-scale declaration of a national emergency in a situation where there's slow-moving events and no actual emergency is absolutely unprecedented.
And Danny, what the law lawsuit is being filed here in the Northern District of California. We're here broadcasting this week. Why here?
Anytime you have a lawsuit like this that could be brought in any of many different federal districts, there's always a strategic reason why. I don't think President Trump's attacks on the Ninth Circuit and the courts in California and elsewhere in the Ninth Circuit are really warranted. The Ninth Circuit isn't some leftist branch of the judiciary, as Trump has accused it of. But strategically, they've decided that based on the case law or whatever the case may be, they have the best advantages filing in the Northern District of California. But I have to say, the challenge here, and believe me, I say this in a way auditioning for Professor Chacon, because my dream job is a UCLA adjunct professorship at the law school. So I'm choosing my words very carefully here. But
smart move, Danny. Smart move.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So the key here in this case is going to be, as Professor Chacon discussed the famous steel mill case, is that case gave us a tripartite framework for deciding whether or not the president acts against the express will of Congress. But again, a preliminary determination has to be, do we even know which category the president's in? For example, it may be the case that the president is acting now and there are senators on both sides of the aisle who are speaking out against what the president is doing. And in that sense, it might be said that he's acting against the express will of Congress. But it could also be said that under certain authorizing statutes, like the two statutes that authorize military spending and military diversion of funds, that Congress has already given its express permission, something that was absent in the Truman steel mill case, where President Truman acted just based on his inherent constitutional authority. But here, expect the president's lawyers to say, no, no, no. It doesn't matter what congressional leaders say today. When they pass that law authorizing this spending at the moment that the president says the words national emergency, it's immaterial whatever else the president said in an offhand speech or whatever he tweeted or whatever individual senators say. Congress has expressly authorized this action. Therefore, the president acts at the peak of his power and his act is constitutionally valid.
Jennifer, also, does this fall in line? Because we know this is a very reactive president. When the president does not get what he wants, he will act. And I'm wondering, does this latest declaration fall in line with sort of this expanding authority of the executive branch, Jennifer?
Yes. So I think that this is a pretty typical move for this president to sort of use national security as a reason or justification for an expansive use of executive authority. And the problem that has just been identified is that Congress has really delegated a great amount of power to the executive branch through things like the National Emergencies Act. And President Trump has a very savvy way of taking advantage of these large grants of power that Congress has seemed to given to the president.
Danny, what is California arguing that how this declaration of a national emergency will hurt the state? Sorry.
You've seized on a key issue, and it goes back to that threshold issue of standing. Each and every state that is joined in this lawsuit must allege some concrete interest in the outcome of the litigation to even get into court. I can't stress how important standing is. You know, you look, and we're not talking about the other lawsuit, which involves landowners. They have a more clear path to standing. These are folks in another lawsuit that are having they're alleging their property is going to be taken from them to build this wall. That more fits the classic definition of standing, that constitutional requirement. But states like California and Connecticut, and the fascinating thing, if you read the complaint, each of them alleges slightly different effects on the state. For example, Colorado says, look, we've got the Air Force Academy, we've got all these bases. If you move those funds around, that affects us. Other states say, well, this will affect our drug interdiction, the funds that we use to fight the war on drugs. And then even other states say that this is diverting funds away from construction efforts or other things. But ultimately, they all have to affect the states. And that's the key. The reality is every single action that the federal government takes has some effect on the states. So the courts are going to have a bit of a challenge here. They're going to have to decide whether or not is any effect on the states, however remote, enough to give the state standing to challenge the federal government in court. It's a battle that the states could possibly lose.
Well, and there's another element of news here. We just heard yesterday that, or just last night, that the Trump administration said it plans to terminate a $929 million federal grant to the California High Speed Rail Authority. Now, in terms of explaining this on Twitter, the president said, basically tied this decision to the wall and said the failed fast train project in California, where the cost overruns are becoming world record setting, basically saying that this is way too expensive. Is this, Danny, direct retaliation that we're seeing here by the president?
You could easily call this retaliation. But in fairness, the federal government has oftentimes used the spending power instead of a direct order to the states in order to get its policy done. This has happened historically many times. For example, the drinking age in the United States is uniformly 21. The federal government made that happen. How? They didn't order the states to do it. They didn't have the power to do that. But instead, they said, hey, states, if you like federal highway funding, everybody better make their drinking age 21, or else you're not getting any of our federal highway funding. And you know what? Within a short period of time, with I believe Louisiana as the last holdout, all the states had to fall in line. While this could easily be perceived as an act of retaliation by Trump, at the same time, historically, the federal government has often used its spending power as a crowbar to get the states to do that which the federal government cannot order the states or commandeer them to do otherwise.
I just want to get one thought in from Jennifer here. How long do you think this process is going to take?
The litigation process? Well, it could take a while. I mean, I think Trump is right that it will be slow moving through the courts, which is ironic given the fact that he has tried to posit this as a national emergency. On the question of whether the states can actually bring these lawsuits, I think it's true that they do need to be able to demonstrate some sort of harm. But it's worth remembering that on much more speculative questionable harms, the Supreme Court allowed them to challenge President Obama's deferred action for parents in Texas versus United States. It looks like the state's harms here are more real and more quantifiable than the harms that they were able to articulate in that case. So it seems like they have some good precedent to articulate a claim of standing in this case.
Jennifer M. Chacon is a law professor at UCLA, and Danny Savalas is a legal analyst with MSNBC. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.